The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Day by day, the situation is worsening in Gaza. Now with the news that the IDF is attempting to take over completely Gaza City. And we know what kind of privations the Palestinians are going to suffer on foot of that. With so many Palestinians dealing with those issues, issues of grief, displacement, there is an epidemic of mental ill health developing in Gaza. It's on a pretty unimaginable scale. And I'll be talking to mental health activity manager for Médecins Sans Frontières, based around Khan Yunis, Zahara Legri, a little later on. But first, yesterday, Israel gave final approval for a controversial settlement project in the occupied West Bank that would effectively cut the territory in two, a move that Palestinians and other groups are saying would destroy hopes for any future Palestinian state. And meanwhile, the go-ahead for the mobilization of some 50,000 reservists in order to proceed with the complete taking over of Gaza City. They say those reservists will not be doing the heavy lifting, but will be replacing members of the permanent defense forces who will be going into Gaza City. To discuss this and more from Israel, we're joined by Tel Aviv-based journalist Paul Kearns. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Can you talk to us, first of all, about the news about Gaza City? The IDF claim they are in control of areas around the city.
Yes, I understand that the plan to that was announced yesterday by Minister Katz has actually started. But the details remain unclear. The proposals have to be presented to the full cabinet security today. But what we do know is that the plan is to transfer Gaza residents to southern Gaza. 130,000 reservists are to be called up. 60,000, I understand, have already called up this week. And in the ominous words of Minister of Defence Katz, to quote him, he says, "Once the operation is completed, Gaza will change its face and will no longer look as it did in the past."
Now, the push of Palestinians southwards, I mean, this is pushing them towards the Egyptian border. And we know that the goal of Israel really is to try and get as many of them permanently into Egypt as they possibly can, because they want to repopulate the Gaza Strip with the Israelis. Will anyone shout stop?
Well, it's the dream, dare I say it, or the goal of the far right to populate Gaza with settlers. Netanyahu has publicly said that it's unlikely or not going to happen. But the goal of entering Gaza, if we take Netanyahu at his word, it's a proposal for defeating Hamas. If we don't take him at his word, and many Israeli political pundits don't, this is a way of prolonging the war to survive politically. There is another interpretation that it's merely a negotiation tactic to put further pressure on Hamas in the negotiations that are currently taking place. But there's a fourth option, and this is a dark one. This is a deliberate pre-planned policy of expulsion and ethnic cleansing, as you say, conceived and led by Netanyahu himself. And actually, that's not my words. That was the editor of Haaretz, Olaf Ben, who wrote that in so many words a couple of weeks ago.
How much resistance is there among ordinary people to the mobilization of reservists? Now, we know that almost every young person in Israel is trained as a reservist, the idea being that you have a relatively small permanent army, but then you can multiply that army many times by calling up the bulk of the young and fit population. But among that cohort, given what they've been seeing from Gaza, the kind of deaths around the food distribution, starvation of children and other family members, the bombing, the killing and so on, is there any, I suppose, movement to try and resist mobilization among ordinary people, not the ultra-Orthodox, which we'll talk about in a moment?
Well, we do know that 70% of Israelis want the war to end now, not for the reasons we would like to believe they should, which is the suffering of Palestinians, but because they see no purpose. They see it as endangering the life of the hostages and endangering the life of reservists. Up to 500,000, the numbers are disputed, but up to 500,000 Israelis were on the streets in Tel Aviv alone on Sunday. They say up to 800,000, 900,000 across the country in a national was described as a national strike. So the anti-war movement is growing and it's getting pretty intense. But, you know, if you have a 500,000 people in Tel Aviv demonstrating against war, and those numbers are staggering given the population of Israel, and then the government decides to plow ahead, you know, it begs the question, what opposition can Israelis, you know, come up with?
Now, meantime, the other decision was to proceed with the resettlement of an area known as E1 to the east of Jerusalem. What is the significance of that resettlement, besides being illegal internationally, but that hasn't stopped settlement in the West Bank anyway? What is the significance of this particular development?
Well, this so-called E1 settlement has been knocking around as a proposal for decades. The significance of it goes ahead, notwithstanding the fact that it's 3,500 new settler homes, is that it's argued that it severs the West Bank in two. Basically, a Palestinian state will it'll be very difficult to have a Palestinian state that is contiguous. Ramallah, the capital, in effect, to the north of the Palestinian Authority, will be cut off from Bethlehem to the south. And it will make it near impossible for the Palestinians to have a capital in East Jerusalem. The minister himself, Smotrich, who's a settler, and his words were pretty, you know, ominous yesterday, I believe. And he said that the Palestinian state has been erased from the table, not with slogans, but with actions. Every settlement, every neighborhood, every housing unit is another nail in the coffin of this dangerous idea.
So this is going to go ahead, that decision, which has been resisted by the international community and pressure kept on Israel to stop it happening. But now, of course, I presume Trump has given them the quiet nod that they can go ahead.
Well, as I said, it's been on the table as a proposal for decades. And, you know, we've had far right governments, or maybe not as far right as this one, in power in Israel, but they've never dared to go ahead because it really, as the minister himself says, is a nail in the coffin for a two-state solution. And you're right. I mean, the only person who can stop any of this in Gaza or other settlements, it's not the United Nations. It's not the European leaders. It's certainly not 500,000 Israelis on the streets. It's Trump.
Now, Paul, tell me about this ultra-Orthodox group of Jewish people, not just in Israel, but elsewhere around the world, who are organizing a day of prayer. What's that about?
Well, the Haredim, or the ultra-Orthodox, which are now about 10% of the population of Israel, have historically been exempted from serving in the army. And the courts have ruled this to be unfair, illegal, discriminatory for almost 20 years, and have demanded the government take action to introduce legislation to address it. You know, each subsequent government has tried to do so, but the courts have got firmer in their demands. And the government, even despite the fact that the ultra-Orthodox are part of the coalition, the government did introduce, or is proposing to introduce, legislation, and there's fierce backlash to it. In fact, two of the coalition parties have temporarily walked away from the government. But there's huge anger among the general population in Israel that the ultra-Orthodox don't serve, especially now that tens of thousands of reservists are serving in Gaza for almost 2 years, and hundreds have died. So it's caused huge division in Israel between secular Israelis, ordinary Israelis, and the Haredim.
All right. Look, thank you very much, Paul, for joining us with the ongoing unfolding story in Israel and in Gaza and the West Bank. But now in studio with me is Zahara Legri, who is Mental Health Activity Manager for Médecins Sans Frontières, based around Khan Yunis. Zahara, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning you were here to talk about the unfolding mental health crisis in Gaza. And I can understand why many people would be suffering because of what they've gone through.
Yes, certainly this time I was in Gaza between April and July. And as compared with December and January, things were significantly worse for people, not just in the sense of the crowding and displacement, where people are much more forced into crowded areas and there's no longer a humanitarian safe zone. There is nowhere that's exempt from attacks, but also in terms of the erosion of any sort of coping mechanism, be that psychological, physical, to do with food and water, societal, to do with safe spaces, regular activity. It's all been very systematically eroded.
How do you cope with helping those children, particularly who have maybe terrible burns or are amputees, or have lost family members, siblings or parents. And then on top of that, they're hungry.
So food and hunger and now increasingly high rates of malnutrition, which we've seen in the last 2 weeks, are very much the forefront of people's concern. And it's really heartbreaking to be in an ICU or a high dependency unit in a makeshift tent hospital and a young child is just crying for a bit of juice and there's nothing to offer. There's nothing even in the store that you can make into something that they small comfort that they need at that time. What we try to do, especially within the mental health team, is to, as much as we can, support psychologically the young people, their families, but also try to build a routine, a sense of normality and a safe space within our hospital and our clinic. There's not much we can do beyond that when they leave, but we also try to map within local communities and link people where possible, because there are far too many times in a week situations where we've had to break the news to children under 10 that their parents and siblings have died in the same incident that brought them into the hospital, requiring them to undergo high levels of medical intervention. And there's so many layers to that situation, not just the complex grief, something that they had feared happening for the last 2 years, which has now come true, but also the burden of the aunt or the grandmother or the wider family taking in another child when they're already struggling to look after their own. So there's a lot that we have to do to try and support people through that. And that's only while they're with us.
I'm just wondering how you even begin to help them with those kind of psychological supports. I'm thinking of a child who's hungry or thirsty and their basic need, which is simply to survive, even though they're already mutilated, perhaps by Israeli bombs or whatever, and they don't have basic nutrition. And then you're trying to help them psychologically. I mean, it's almost like, let's get you physically well first. And then, and that's not what you can do, because you can't get them necessarily fed and watered.
Well, we do our best to try and feed patients while they're with us in hospital. We don't do food distribution. We do water and sanitation within the communities, but we're not able to provide food within the wider community, but as much as we can, because it is a medical requirement for people to be nourished as much as possible to heal. And actually, we have seen very poor rates of healing from burns, different skin grafts and amputations and wounds,
simply because
there's
a lack of
nutrition. Nourished. Yeah, exactly.
So going forward, what will these children have to cope with after they're discharged from hospital? They no longer need the medical help, although they may be on crutches or immobilized in various ways. They might be carried home, whatever home might be, by a relative. What lies ahead for them in terms of their mental health? I mean, it's pretty desperate.
It's honestly very hard to predict. What I saw amongst children and adults is the initial syndromes of stress or trauma reactions that were happening 6 months ago after a year and a half of the war have now kind of progressed to much more depression and anxiety syndromes, which is a result of a kind of chronic impact of stress and trauma on somebody's nervous system. It gets tired and they start to develop things that look more like disorders, more chronic disorders. For children, I've said it before and I'll say it again, they're extremely resilient, but they need structure, age-appropriate activity, play, to have normality. And like most children are not only experiencing something that is hard to imagine and fathom for any human being, systematic, you know, grief, bereavement, displacement, but also they are 2 years into a total lack of schooling, structure. There is all the emblems of society around the south in Rafah and in Gaza City, where I also spent quite a lot of time, have been destroyed.
Yeah.
So they don't recognize their sense of home either, which is
But this for the child, it's a bit like a prize fighter who's knocked down and then gets up again. But then they're knocked down again. And then they get up again. Mm-hmm. Then they get knocked down again. And finally, they don't get up. You know, that the child's spirit is broken by grief upon grief upon grief.
I think actually when the way I saw people there, they're, as I said to you before, I think they're extremely spiritual and they believe in a divine kind of path so that they can give that and to God, so to speak, in the sense that they don't question. But and the adults are the ones that I'm noticing are much more despondent. The children are displacing that somewhere in their young minds psychologically to be able to play, to be able to enjoy. But their play is much more agitated and heightened. So that's what I've noticed. I think when things stop, if they stop soon, I hope, that's when we'll notice some of the more psychological impacts on children. Certainly, they're elevated in society as well.
Do they want to get out of Gaza? I mean, it's a big question because for maybe the younger, more vigorous adults, they'd say, no, we're going to rebuild our home. For older people, they might say, no, I've got to get out of here and I've got to take my loved ones with me. It's the only way.
It's actually the inverse for a lot of people I spoke to. Those who are older, who've lived through rounds and rounds of this, who were maybe displaced from what is now Israel two generations ago, they're the ones who want to stay. Those who are younger without possible roots, or everyone has roots there, but those who are maybe can build a life somewhere else, they're looking at leaving. But all of them need to know or have the right to know if they can return. I think the world expects people to want to move, but these are indigenous people, very rooted in their land.
I mean, this is an argument that's still going on about 1948, mm-hmm. and the Palestinians who were displaced at that time, and part of the negotiations in less militarily troubled times was about the right to return, which seems to be completely forsaken by Israel at any rate. There would be no right to return.
I think the conditions in there are so difficult that you know, everyone is asking and talking about that and asking themselves that question about leaving. But they love their land and they are worried about what will happen if they abandon it. Mm. At the same time, it's not just staying or fleeing to safety. We have to be realistic as well. And they are realistic. They've told me this themselves. Many of my colleagues that I spoke to, what is life where we moved to? Are they welcome in every country? Is it easy for them to integrate? Can they build a life? Because actually the quality of life in Gaza, even though there was blockade and, difficult history, it was a high quality of life before this war, actually.
Well, everything is relative, I suppose. But I mean, if the money that Hamas accumulated instead of building tunnels, which they're probably delighted that they built now because they offer some sort of safety from the IDF. But if that money had been spent on building a better civil society, Gaza might be a really nice place to live.
So a lot of the buildings that were destroyed from Gaza City are old Ottoman buildings. There's a very interesting historian called Jean-Pierre Filieu. He's written a lot of the history of Gaza from going way back when. And actually, a lot of the structures around there go way back.
So history being obliterated as well.
Yeah.
We spoke to you before after your last visit, and then you were wondering, you know, can I go back? Do I want to go back? I must go back. And you did. You went back. How difficult is it for you and your colleagues to get in and out of Gaza to do the vital work that you do?
Since the end of the ceasefire around March, it's been very difficult to secure spots to get in and out because there are limited spaces a couple of times a week. The transfers in and out have to be coordinated through the UN. With the various parties, they're often cancelled because the fighting is a little bit less, strange to say this, but predictable and rules-based. Yeah. It's a little bit kind of...
Sure. Well, when we saw around the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation feeding stations that people, it seems, were randomly being picked off, and whether for sport or for security is a very open question.
One of the times I left, I passed down through Rafah and passed all of the destruction. There was nothing. There's nothing left. There's a lot of construction, not sure what. And I saw the construction of one of the hubs down there. It's kilometres into wasteland with a lot of military presence. And whether or not who it is, why it's happening, what the goal is, I think your previous guest was kind of talking about a few different reasons. It does result in what looks like systematic and intentional impact on human dignity and ethnic cleansing.
Zahra Legri, thank you very much for joining us. Zahra works for Médecins Sans Frontières, hoping to improve the mental health of many of those children, particularly in Gaza, who are suffering and will continue to suffer, it looks like. Thank you very much for joining us in the studio.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.